Shrink Wrap Radio number 548, Carl Jung's Evolving Views of Nazi Germany with Dr. William Shanel.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with William Shanel, Professor Emeritus of Modern European History at Michigan State University. William and Linda Shanel's book, Jung's Evolving Views of Nazi Germany, describes for the first time Jung's views of Nazi Germany. For more information about Dr. William Shanel, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Dr. William Shanel, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
I know you've encouraged me to call you Bill, but since on this show I'm calling myself Dr. Dave, I figure I should give equal time. So I'm really pleased to have you on the show because your book, which you co-wrote with your wife, Linda Shanel, addresses something I've always wondered about. And let me just show I've got the book right here. I can show it to people who are watching us on video. It's a slim volume, but very important and meaty nonetheless. It's titled Jung's Evolving Views of Nazi Germany from the Nazi Takeover to the End of World War II. But before we get into your book, let me back up a bit and ask about your background. You're a historian, right?
Yeah, I have a PhD from Columbia University, and I taught modern European history at Michigan State University for 45 years.
Wow.
I retired in 2013.
Yeah, a long time. And you co-wrote this book with your wife, right?
Right.
And how and when did you and your wife get interested in the Jungian world? I assume you are, since you wrote this book.
Right. I became interested in the 1980s when colleagues of mine at the Department of the Humanities, I was in the Department of Humanities at Michigan State University at the time, were interested in Jung. And they got me interested, and I became quite interested. In 1991, I was on leave for a term. I got a leave and took some courses at the Jung Institute in Küsnacht. And after that, I began research and writing on Jung and published a couple books on him. And then I was on sabbatical in 2007, and my wife and I began research on the present book. She helped me with the research and the writing and the editing of the book.
So I take it neither of you have been in Jungian analysis?
No.
Okay, but you did go to Küsnacht and did some study there. That sounds delightful. So when did you two decide to take on this book project regarding Jung's views of Nazi Germany?
We decided to take on the research project in 2007, and then it became a number of articles that we wrote and published. Some I did by myself, some with another person, some with Linda. And it wasn't until last January that we decided to make it a book.
Uh-huh.
And so we wrote the epilogue to the book. We rewrote the other parts and submitted it to Chiron, and there it is.
Yeah. So what was behind that decision, other than the fact that, I don't know if there was something other than the fact that you had these articles laying around, or was there something else prompting you to get it out there in a book?
Well, it seemed to me a nice way of bringing all our research together. Secondly, it would get it out there. So I think those are the two basic reasons. Okay. I think it makes it more readable to more people when it's in book form than simply an article in a journal or series of articles in journals.
Sure. So once again, the full title is Jung's Evolving Views of Nazi Germany from the Nazi Takeover to the End of World War II. How were you able to do the background research these many years later? And did you encounter any challenges as you tried to research this topic?
Yeah, those are two good questions. One, I had already done the background when I began my work in Kusnacht in 1991. I had begun research and writing on Jung. And I recall at the time hearing the question, was Jung a Nazi sympathizer and anti-Semitic? And in 1991, I thought, no, of course not. He's not a Nazi sympathizer in any way and not anti-Semitic in any way. And then as I began studying the question more, I realized it was more complicated than that. So that began my looking into research into the question. And I included some of it in my book on Jung and Mary Mellon, J.B. Priestley, in 1998. And in my book, Major Issues in the Life and Work of C.G. Jung, in 1996. So I've been interested for a long time in the background to it.
Mm-hmm. Would you say your book breaks new ground in understanding Jung's attitudes and behavior during that time?
Oh, absolutely. I think it shows that, number one, that in Nazi Germany's first year, that he was somewhat unwary of the Nazis and made some anti-Semitic statements, occasional anti-Semitic statements, and I think the book documents that. And then I think in spring 1934, he went through a transition in which he became warier of the Nazis and of anti-Semitic statements or statements that might seem anti-Semitic. And thereafter, he became increasingly warier of the Nazis. I think the book shows all that.
Yeah, it does. You just gave a capsule summary of the whole book there.
Yeah.
Your book takes up the story, as you say, in 1933. And there were two things at issue, which you've already mentioned. Was Jung sympathetic to the Nazi regime? And was Jung anti-Semitic? And I'm really happy for your book because, as I say, that's something as a person who's long been very enthusiastic about Jung's work, and I've interviewed quite a few Jungian analysts in this forum, and I always kind of look up to them because they tend to have a lot of erudition and to have been deep students of mythology and symbols and other things like that. And but I had heard rumors of Jung as being anti-Semitic and being pro-Nazi, and this seemed not to jibe at all with the Jung that I was aware of or thought that I was aware of. So I think this book really is an important contribution, and I hope it gets wide exposure. Hitler becomes Chancellor of Germany early in 1933. And maybe you can give us a sense of the political background or backdrop around that, his rise to power.
The Weimar Republic had been in deep trouble since 1929 when the Depression began in Germany. There had been a couple chancellors who preceded Hitler who acted in more or less an authoritarian manner. And one of them, von Papen, and the president, von Hindenburg, thought it would be a good idea to bring Hitler in as chancellor since his party had achieved the most votes in the previous election, not the majority of votes, but nevertheless the most. And they thought they could control Hitler. And so they brought Hitler into the cabinet and some Nazis, Hitler as chancellor, thinking they could control him, and that backfired. They did not realize what would happen.
Yeah. Well, part of Jung's problems begin when he accepts the presidency of the General Medical Society for Psychotherapy, which you abbreviate GSMP throughout the book. What can you tell us about that society at that time that he became president?
The previous president had resigned. He was a German, and he realized that it just wasn't workable for him to remain president with the Nazis tightening the screws on psychotherapists in Germany. So some people began to look to Jung as a neutral source, being Swiss, and Jung was vice president of the association, as someone who could take over the helm without with being acceptable to all sides. and without being under the control of the government of Germany. At least that was the feeling of others who were not pro-Nazi within the psychotherapy community in Germany. So for these reasons, he was elevated to that position. It was a rather natural succession anyway. He was vice president and became president.
Okay. So on the one hand, Jung recognizes early on the archetypal element in the Nazi frenzy, but initially he seems undecided as to whether it bodes for ill or good. So he's kind of trying to keep an open mind.
He is.
Anything more you want to say about that particular part of it?
Yeah, Joseph Henderson, who became a noted Jungian psychologist later, was studying a medicine in London at the time in early 1933. And he writes Jung and asks Jung what he thinks of the new Nazi government. And Jung responds that he's uncertain where the Nazi movement is tending. He doesn't know. It might bring some new thing of value into the world, or it might just carry off people to their madness. And that's where he is in early 1933. He doesn't know where the government or the movement is tending, and that's where many people were in 1933.
Yeah, yeah. One of the people in the account is a Matthias H. Goering.
Yeah.
And so I immediately, I went, wow, is he related to the infamous Hermann Goering?
Yeah, he's his cousin.
I went to Wikipedia, and that's what I saw. And furthermore, I saw that Matthias Goering was a psychiatrist trained into the Adlerian approach and a high-ranking Nazi.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, what was it about the Adlerian approach that made it appeal to Nazis?
Maybe the emphasis on power. And I don't know that closely, but I would think it's the emphasis on power that would be of appeal to the Nazis.
I think in the book you also mentioned something about community feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm not deep on Adler either, so it's been a while since I looked at Adler. You report that Jung said, or was reported to have said, some unfortunate things early in his tenure as head of the GMSP. I don't know if you have those at hand or if you can remember them. Maybe you can give us a sense of them.
Well, I'll start with a statement that is obviously anti-Semitic, and it was recorded in the unpublished notebooks of Esther Harding, which I've seen. She had an analytic session with Jung in November 1933, and she recorded in her notebook that day that he had said that German Jews drank champagne at Montreux when Germany was starving. And he felt sorry for individual hardship, but felt that Jews as a whole deserved it.
But that was that old perception that the Jews are all rich and controlling everything.
Yeah. And you mentioned community feeling, and I think it relates. Meidenbaum, in his book on Jung and anti-Semitism, his more recent book, the second book, says that he believes that Jung was not consciously anti-Semitic, but that he had an unconscious cultural prejudice. And I think Meidenbaum is right about that. Mm-hmm. I think Jung shared some anti-Semitic feeling that was common in contemporary culture in Switzerland at the time. Anti-Semitism was not uncommon, and I think Jung picked up some, as Meidenbaum says, unconscious prejudice from his contemporary culture.
Yeah. Another major dynamic that you examined was that Freud and his psychoanalysis were seen as a Jewish psychotherapy, and Jung made some references to Jewish versus Aryan psychotherapy.
Oh, that's very interesting. There are letters of Jung to Wolfgang Kronefeld, who was his assistant in Germany, in Switzerland, and then left to become a psychologist in Berlin. And the letters to Kronenfeld that are of particular importance in regard to this are December 1933 and February 1934. And there Jung writes of, he asks in the first letter, Kronenfeld, to write an article contrasting Freud's negative, quote, Jewish psychology with Jung's psychology, supporting Jung's standpoint. And in the second letter, the letter to Kronenfeld in February 1934, he speaks in favor of the German government suppressing what he refers to as public preaching of Freudian psychology in Germany, and again uses the term Freudian Jewish psychology. Now, the letters smack of anti-Semitism, and this is additional evidence beyond the letter to the record in Harding's notebooks at the time. These three evidence then I think point strongly, and I think are sufficient evidence that he did make some anti-Semitic statements at the time, and one could cite others. This is early on, the first year of Nazi Germany. But there's a second important point here, and that is that Jung wanted to promote his psychology, that is Jungian psychology, in Germany. And these two letters to Kronenfeld are clear evidence that this is what he wanted to do.
Yeah, that to me was a very interesting dynamic that maybe we'll discuss some more as we go along. So in addition to Jung's anti-Semitism, unconscious anti-Semitism at the beginning of this period, on the other hand, you report that Jung took an active stance toward the GSMP becoming an international organization.
Yes.
Rather than one dominated by Germany.
And exactly. He didn't want it to be under the control of the Nazi government, and he didn't want it to be under the control of Germany. Exactly.
Yeah, and I believe he explicitly insisted that it should be open to Jews. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
He worked this in. He wrote new statutes for the GMSP in 1934 to make it really an international organization. And in the new statutes, he included a provision explicitly that would allow Jews to become members of the international society without being members of the society in Germany, where they would not be welcome or would be expelled or subject to all sorts of restrictions.
Mm-hmm. You also report that Jung's unconscious attitudes were counterbalanced by various friendships with Jews and I think clients as well, analysands probably, and particularly his relationship with Erich Neumann, a Jewish protege who wrote a powerful letter to Jung calling upon him to become aware of his anti-Semitic attitudes and to go beyond them. Can you take us through that?
That's very interesting. Jung had had many Jewish clients, patients, and many who he developed friendships with as well. And so this is one side of it, alongside the unconscious cultural prejudice. For example, where he made the statement, at least as reported by Harding, that is anti-Semitic in November 1933, in the same month he retained as editor of the review section of the Zentralblatt für Psychotherapie, which is the journal of the GMSP, and Jung was now its editor as president. He retained a man who was Jewish, an Adlerian Austrian psychologist, at a time when it would have been unpopular to do so in the eyes of the Nazis. So you have these two different things, the many friendships, and on the other hand, an unconscious prejudice.
Yeah, although, you know, people would probably remark that we certainly are aware of many instances in this country of people who are prejudiced against the group, but somehow make exceptions for individuals.
Right.
You write that after Nazi Germany's first year,
May I just add a comment?
Yeah.
I wouldn't I wouldn't say that Jung was prejudiced against Jews as a group, not at all. I would only say that he made some occasional statements, anti-Semitic statements, especially in 1933. He became aware of this. He later did not make such statements. And he's sharing a prejudice that was common among people at the time, but was not directed against the group or individuals. Mm-hmm. That is, Jews as a group or individuals.
Okay. You write that after Nazi Germany's first year, it's untenable to hold that Jung was a Nazi sympathizer.
Right.
Which you've just kind of reinforced just now. Once again, what is that statement based on? You've mentioned a couple of things here.
Okay. It's spring 1934 when he goes through a transition. And I need to give a bit of background here. Gustav Bali was a psychoanalyst who fled Germany and was in Switzerland in 1933. And he read Jung's article when he became editor of the Zentralblatt. He published an editorial in December 1933 in the Zentralblatt. And in that article, he distinguished between Jewish and German psychology. And he added that this shows no inferiority of Jewish psychology, a statement that was later ignored or dropped or omitted by many critics. But he does distinguish between Jewish and German psychology in this editorial. And he furthermore says that
Jung does. Okay.
And he furthermore says the time has come when these differences are no longer to be glossed over. And Bali wrote an article that was published in Jung's hometown newspaper, the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, in late February 1934, that accused Jung of racial prejudice because of this editorial. And I think it is this and Neumann's letter to Jung that made Jung aware of the danger of being unwary of the Nazis and of making statements that might seem anti-Semitic. And right after Bali's article appeared, Jung enters into transition in which you can see him becoming warier of the Nazis. There's a very important letter that was published for the first time in this book by the leader of the Dutch Society of Psychotherapists, Vanderhoop. And the Dutch Society had a meeting and had decided that they felt there was a real danger that the GMSP might come under German domination because the majority of members of the GMSP at the time were German. And they saw this as a real danger. And also they wanted some psychotherapists in Germany. And they had in mind, in particular, Jewish psychotherapists. They wanted them to be able to become members of the GMSP, of the international GMSP, even if they could not become members of the German section. So they told Jung these two things were important to them. Jung read Vanderhoop's letter, and he responded, yes, first of all, I'm working on new statutes, and I think this is probably when he really began to seriously write those new statutes after Vanderhoop's letter. And he said, I'm going to write new statutes for the international GMSP, and they will contain a provision allowing people to join as the international GMSP without being members of the German section. And secondly, there's going to be a provision in these statutes that provides that the heads of the GMSP, that is president, vice president, et cetera, will not be elected by the membership at large, because if they were, that would mean that it could be German domination. Most members are German. But we are going to provide that the heads, the president, vice president, will be elected in a representative assembly. And in that representative assembly, any German, possible German domination can be paralyzed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You also mentioned that Jung perceived the Nazi movement as archetypal.
Well, I'm sorry, but then I can go further, and there are other things. April 1934, he writes a letter to Gustav Heyer, who was a psychotherapist and a friend in Germany. And in November, you mentioned Goering, Matthias Goering, the cousin of Hermann Goering, who is now head of the German section of the GMSP. And in November 1933, when Jung writes to Ahlers, who was the head of the review section of these Natural Blatt, and who is Jewish, and who Jung retained as editor of the review section, he wrote to Ahlers in 1933 that Hermann Goering has become head of the German section, and Goering is an amiable and very reasonable fellow. He looks forward to their cooperation. And then in April 1934, he writes to Heyer that Goering's motives are so obscure that he cannot rely on Goering. The contrast in what he writes in first year Nazi Germany and during this transition in spring 1934. And again, the contrast to what he says about Freud in the letters to Kronefeld in December and February 33 and 34, that is still during Nazi Germany's first year approximately. And then he goes to the Baden-Dauheim Congress of the GMSP in May. And at that Congress, besides getting through these new statutes, he gives a lecture in which he praises Freud as a psychological pioneer who put forward the first medical theory of the unconscious. And some Nazis are angry at this favorable reference to Freud. But again, the contrast, because what he says, the negative things, the letters to Kronefeld in Nazi Germany's first year, and what he says toward the end of this transition in spring 1934, just striking.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there are several mentions of Jung's archetypal views of what was going on with the Nazis. And in particular, you mentioned that he came to see archetypal significance in the symbol of the swastika. Maybe you could tell us about that.
Yeah, the swastika on the Nazi flag, for example, moves in a counterclockwise direction. And he takes this up in seminars that he gave on Nietzsche in 1934 and 35 when he's asked about this by his audience. He in one of the seminars, he sees the swastika. He notes the black color, and he sees the swastika moving in a counterclockwise direction. And he sees this as Nazis falling into evil and the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, "But I'm not making judgments. I'm just making observations." And a person in the seminar who is pro-Nazi, one of the few in the seminar, I take it, but a person in the seminar who is pro-Nazi, says to him that she believes sometimes in history there has to be regression before there can be leaps forward. And Jung replies, "But sometimes in history there is no leap forward."
You write that both Hitler and Mussolini evoked the savior archetype among their people, and that they also came to see themselves as the embodiment of their people's unconscious. Yeah. That, in fact, they, along with Hitler, became possessed.
Yeah, that's interesting, too. He gives a talk at the Tavistock Institute in London in October 1935. And in the talk, he says that people in Germany and Italy are developing a savior complex, and they're projecting the savior archetype on Hitler and Mussolini. Right, and then in October 1936, he goes back to the Tavistock Institute and gives another talk. And in this second talk, and this illustrates how, as time goes on, he's becoming increasingly warier of the Nazis. In the second talk, he's much more speaks much stronger negatively about the Nazis than in the first talk in October 1935, although there he's already negative. But in the second talk, he refers to the state as being the new slave owner in Italy and Germany and the Soviet Union as well, enslaving people body and soul. Wolfhounds, he says, plain clothes and uniformed policemen now guard the sheep who are utterly deprived of all rights. And only duties, no rights remain. And this is very strongly negative language about those regimes.
Sure, sure. And he also uses later on the term medicine man about Hitler, with, I think, a less positive valence than we might have today. But he was, I guess it relates to the idea of the savior, that we have a hunger for somebody who can cure our ills. And
that's right.
Hitler was perceived in that way as...
yes, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
You write that many psychotherapists, including Jung, admired Hitler's leadership. And it was kind of like they say, Mussolini made the trains run on time. He could make things happen.
This was an accusation against Jung rather recently by Frosch in 2005 in a journal article. And it's not true. Frosch wrote exactly what you say, but Jung did not admire Hitler. That is not at all true. He found Hitler, I think, an interesting psychological specimen, but admiration, no.
No. And you also portray Jung as doing his best to distance himself from politics, that he felt that psychotherapy and politics should be two very separate domains.
Yes, yeah. And that's one reason why I think he remained president of the GMSP for so long, that he wanted and he felt that they could be separate, but in fact, in the end, they couldn't.
Yeah, yeah. You know, right now there's a real struggle in the professional associations, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association, about whether or not it's appropriate to speak out with psychological diagnoses, psychopathic diagnoses of political leaders. Mm-hmm. And that's very current. We'll come back to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see, you described that, I want to skip ahead here. At one point you mentioned that Jung was in Berlin and he had the opportunity to witness a parade of soldiers and armaments. I don't know if Hitler was there
right
for that. And he remarked that archetypes were already walking in the streets.
Right. He went to Berlin to speak to the Jung Gesellschaft, the Jung association there. And while he was there, he saw a military parade. And he noticed the strength of German armaments in the parade. By that time, 1937, Hitler had really built the German army up. And he said that he now realized that if war did come, it was going to be far bloodier and immense than he had thought.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another turning point. Turning point might be too strong a word. That's another important development in his thought about Nazi Germany, that if war does happen, it's going to be terrible now.
Yeah. Yeah. I was interested to learn that Jung traveled to America to receive an honorary doctorate from Harvard.
Yeah, yeah.
I hadn't known that. Was there a controversy around that?
There was. The Crimson published an article, taking up his article in the Central Blot, December 1933, and accusing him of Nazi sympathy. And he was defended by an assistant professor at Harvard at the time, and there was some debate, but Harvard decided to award him the honorary degree. They didn't allow what was published in the Crimson to hold that up.
Yeah, I knew about the Freud and Jung trip to Clark University early on, but the Harvard was new to me. Also, that he lectured at Yale, that was new to me.
Oh, yeah, the Terry lectures.
And also he lectured at the Tavistock Clinic in London, which seems to be a very prominent place in the development of psychotherapy.
Yeah.
After Kristallnacht in 1938, in which Nazis destroyed Jewish synagogues and property and also beat up and killed Jews, you say Jung became very active in assisting Jews to escape the country.
He did. He did.
That's good. That's to his credit.
Many people saw the handwriting on the wall then.
Do I understand that Hitler's invasion of Poland was a real turning point for Jung and the Swiss generally, feeling that Germany had lost its honor to an unspeakable degree?
Yeah, Jung now, with World War II having begun with the invasion of Poland, Jung now becomes anti-Nazi in things that that he says. So, whereas before, as president of the GMSP, he's trying to he'll say things that are negative about Nazi Germany sometimes in lectures and speeches, but publicly, I think he's not trying to take an anti-Nazi stance. He's trying to remain neutral and hold this association together. But with the war coming, he becomes very strongly anti-Nazi and will speak like that openly in letters, et cetera, to our friends.
He even moved his family to the Swiss Alps, fearing that Germany would possibly
invade
Switzerland.
Yeah, there was a real fear Germany might invade Switzerland, and the Swiss were prepared to sacrifice the lowlands in Switzerland and were building up military defenses in the Alps, and Jung moved his family to the Alps, right?
And you also write that Jung was especially distressed by the London bombings because he had spent significant amount of time there at the Tavistock Clinic and so on, and that he almost felt it as a second home.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, he said he felt as if his own homeland had been bombed when London was bombed.
Yeah. I was particularly struck by Jung's 1942 observation that the continent vibrated with rumors and lies, and it was nearly impossible to tell true from false information. That sounds very contemporary.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
We can come back to that, maybe.
Yeah.
So there began to be allegations in the U.S. You already mentioned one that was happening around Jung getting that honorary doctorate at Harvard. There began to be more and more allegations in the U.S. that Jung was pro-Nazi, to the extent that the FBI launched two investigations.
Right.
What was the source of these rumors?
That is a good question. I think that's when the allegations that Jung was pro-Nazi, or at least a Nazi sympathizer, and anti-Semitic, really begin in the United States. There are instances before, but from that time on, almost to the present day, you'll find those allegations. And it begins with two things. It begins with an anonymous phone call from somebody to the FBI saying that Jung was pro-Nazi and he's now in the United States, and suggesting the FBI investigate.
And that wasn't true. He was not in the United States.
Yeah, okay. Was in Switzerland. Yeah, not in the United States at all. But the phone call I under the Freedom of Information Act, I got the file on Jung from the FBI, but any indication of who the sources were has been deleted from the file, so there's no way of telling who this anonymous caller was. But the further background is that Freudians in the United States were already making allegations against Jung.
Yeah, that was interesting to me because today I think Freudians and Jungians live pretty peaceably, is my sense from the interviews that I've done in both camps, and I've never gotten any sense of hostility. But I gathered in the early days where these two movements were relatively young. Young, not Jung.
Yes, right.
that actually there was maybe some active enmity.
Yeah, there was. There was. On both sides.
On both sides, yeah.
There was a committee created around Freud to protect his theories and to take on theories that might be opposed to Freud. And Jung made some strongly anti-Freudian remarks, too, in talks he gave in the 1920s. So, yeah, on both sides, there's enmity.
Huh. That's human
now, this doesn't mean all Freudians, all Jungians, but you'll find some Freudians and Jung himself showing enmity during this period.
Yeah, human beings will be human beings.
Yeah. Yeah.
Going back to that organization that Jung was the head of, it was an association for psychotherapists. Were there any other sorts of psychotherapists other than Freudians and Jungians at that
point?
Well,
there were Adlerians.
So that was a significant enough school to be considered separate.
Yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Do you think there are lessons we should be drawing from those turbulent times in Europe and the situation today here in the U.S. and Europe?
That's a good question, and I have not actually reflected on that. One thing I might say. You mentioned the reference in 1942 about the difficulty in determining what is true and what is false information.
Right.
And one thing I might say is that I was once asked, and this is just very personal, it's only my own slant, my only point of view, my own opinion, but I was once asked by students in class what TV sources they would recommend to learn about the news. And I said, none of them. I said, only PBS News at the time, Jim Lehrer was the head of it. And I said, only PBS News with Jim Lehrer and BBC World, not BBC Britain, which in my opinion has gone downhill, but BBC World. Today, if I were asked the same question, to be honest, I think PBS has gone downhill since Jim Lehrer's time. And I've watched BBC World at times lately, and I don't find it as reliable as it used to be. So if students were asked to ask me the same question today, I might say, do not rely on TV news. Read widely and don't read any one source.
Yeah.
And I think this is part of the problem today. People relying on pro-Trumpian sources or anti-Trumpian sources and not reading various sources and independently making up their own minds for themselves.
Yeah. I have a sense that what we see happening in Europe and here is looking for the strong man archetype.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of the hero, the medicine man, the savior. It feels like there is a rebirth of that.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. And I try not to take political sides.
Like Jung. Me too. I try to be apolitical, but as Jung was forced into a corner, it feels like we may be forced into a corner as well.
Yeah, and it depends on the issue. On certain issues, I'm liberal, and certain issues, I'm conservative. I try to be independent. That's right. One has to come to some opinions on Trump and the Trumpian administration. Right.
Yeah.
And on their critics as well.
It was what you said about the news. It's interesting to me that that did not motivate your writing this book. I thought, whoa, this is a timely book. but that wasn't really your impulse.
No, it wasn't the impulse. It wasn't the motivation, no.
And particularly when I encounter the thing about the rumors and the false news and so on. And today we're hearing this term, the fake news, and we're seeing the news attacked. It's so I'm not going to try to push you any harder than I have. As we wind down here, are there any last thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think you've covered the ground very well. And okay. I think we've covered the ground well. And I'm very happy.
Well, Bill Shainel, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio. I didn't think until after the interview was over to ask Bill how his book has been received by readers other than the reviewers. He said that Chiron, the publisher, has told him that it's turned out to be one of their best sellers. I told him I have two theories about that. One, even though he and his wife did not set out to write it as a commentary on current political events in this country and Europe, my guess is many will want to read it for that very reason, for the parallels that likely exist. And two, at 65 pages, it's probably the shortest Jungian book ever written. So many Jungian books, in my experience, are often long and challenging tomes. Another thing I meant to highlight in the interview and forgot to is Bill's observation that Jung did not put up as good a defense of the attacks against him as he might have. He never came out and said, "Yes, I had some attitudes and beliefs in 1933 that I rather quickly realized were off the mark and that I now regret. As the war went on and the horrors of the Nazi rule became apparent, my views about the Nazis changed completely." Well, he never said anything like that, unfortunately. Another surprising thing for me to emerge from the book and the interview is that here we have Matthias Göring, a cousin of the war criminal Hermann Göring, who is an Adlerian psychiatrist and for a while the president of the General Medical Society for Psychotherapy. A Nazi psychotherapist gives me pause for thought. It really underscores the danger for psychotherapists of becoming unconsciously co-opted into helping people adjust to what may be a sick norm. I do think this slim volume is an important reminder of how a whole people can be led astray by a strong, charismatic leader. And, as you heard, I learned things about Jung and that period in German history that I didn't know. As I say, it's a slim volume, and you'll learn a lot in short order. As always, you're encouraged to use our Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar should you decide to order Jung's Evolving Views of Nazi Germany by William and Linda Shainel. Shainel is spelled S-C-H-O-E-N-L.
Hey, Dr. Dave. Thanks for bringing us your show. I value the open-heartedness and humor you show your guests and all of us as you delve into topics. It informs both my personal journey and my work with clients. I give to Shrink Wrap Radio for the same reason I give to other institutions that feed my mind and heart. It's to complete the energetic circuit. As I receive, so I give. Keep up the great work.
Thank you, Ron Sala. I love your observation about keeping up the circuit. If you're not already a regular supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio, won't you please answer Ron Sala's call to action? Now, speaking of donors, Most people use the support button on our website. However, there is one person who sends me a check each and every month, and I don't have her email address to thank her. So, Barbara Black of Portland, Oregon, I hope you're listening now, as I'm thanking you for your steadfast support. As you may already know, for a couple of years or so, I also had a similar interview-based podcast called Wise Counsel. You can still find those interviews on the web by going to tinyurl.com/ZFOWZVH, or by clicking on the link that you'll find in the About Dr. Dave tab on our website at the end of the sixth paragraph down. Those interviews are timeless, if I do say so myself.
Hi, this is Australian psychologist and author Dr. James Alexander, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, my good friend from Down Under, Dr. James Alexander, whom I interviewed on number 341, The Hidden Psychology of Pain. If you haven't heard it, that's a really good one. And he interviewed me on episode number 397. Now, here's a recent email from our listener community. It's from Azriel, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. How are you? Thankfully, I'm doing great. I listened to Mark Susnow's podcast when he interviewed you about synchronicity. Of course, I listened to the Shrink Wrap Radio episode when you discussed the jaw-dropping synchronicity of finding your biological father. Certainly, I have heard you discuss this topic on many occasions in various episodes. As a religious person, I must ask you, is belief in synchronicity a type of belief in a God, or is it possible to be an atheist and still believe in synchronicity? Additionally, if the answer to the first question is that on a certain level, belief in synchronicity equals belief in God, does this also mean that this is a form of divine providence? I have gathered from different comments you've made that you believe that synchronicity does not require providence. Rather, there are universal, quotes, forces, I'm not sure what word to use, that interact with our thoughts and feelings, that send energy out to the universe that can bring about these synchronistic events. It seems that might be how Jung perceives synchronicity, based on what I've heard in his name. But I would love to hear what your thoughts on the matter are. All the best, and keep up your incredible work until 120. I think that's in response to another listener who had written that she hoped that I would keep going till I was 120 years old. Well, hello again, Azriel. Always good to hear from you. And I'm afraid I've had a relapse and have had a fever the past couple of days, and I'm still got a cough that I'm on the edge of, so I'll have to keep this very short. First of all, thanks for going to the bother of finding Susnow's interview with me about synchronicity, and listeners can find that in the tab on shrinkwrapradio.com under the tab that's called In the Media. So I want to thank you for going to the bother of finding that and listening to it. And the funny thing is that I recalled yesterday something that I realized I should add to my list of big synchronicities in my life. The only thing is now I can't remember it for the life of me. It was so clear, and I thought, oh yeah, that I've got to mention that one. And I've been thinking about it for days now, and I cannot remember it. And no, I don't think you have to believe in God to believe in or experience synchronicities. It does suggest something is going on that we don't understand, but I'm sorry, I don't have a theory for it that I'm attached to. There are various theories out there about it, including Jung's remarks, and you know, that's about as close as I've gotten. And there are the people who appeal to non-Newtonian quantum physics. I don't know if I fully buy those explanations. It's just something that I think happens, And I suppose I should be a lot more curious about it, about the theory than I am. May have something to do with being under the weather. Sorry. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. There's that cough. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. William Shainel, for clearing up the confusion around accusations of Jung as pro-Nazi and or anti-Semitic. Next week, my guest will be UK psychiatrist Ben Sessa, who's written and spoken extensively on the use of certain psychedelics as legitimate psychotherapeutic interventions. So I hope you'll join us. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Shrinkwrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.